This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. A new HBO series called Enlightened premiered last week. Part comedy, part drama, it's about stress and the difficulty of staying calm and focused. Our first guest, Mike White, co-created the show with Laura Dern, who also stars in it. Mike White also wrote the movies Year of the Dog and The School of Rock. Terry spoke with White last week. In Enlightened, Laura Dern is a former executive at a global conglomerate who has a humiliating emotional meltdown at the office and is forced to take a time out. She goes to a holistic mental health treatment center in Hawaii, where she feels at peace near the ocean and learns how to meditate. In the premiere episode, she returns home. Well, not exactly home. She moves in with her mother. And now she's facing a strained relationship with her mother and a demotion at work. Mike White plays one of the guys working in the section to which she's been demoted. She's trying to maintain the calm that she found meditating in Hawaii, but it isn't easy. In this scene, she's seated cross-legged on her bed, beginning to meditate.
Breathe, relax into my body, totally present, focusing on one spot. I see my hand, I see wrinkles, my skin. I'm 40. I'm severely dehydrated. I need to drink more water. Relax, breathe. Picturing yourself somewhere calming.
Mike White, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back again. Congratulations on this new series. That scene that we just heard is a great illustration of the way you can just start judging or attacking yourself while you're trying to sit still and breathe and get in a meditative state. But you know, with the Laura Dern character, Amy, after she starts like getting really neurotic about things, she does get to that quieter place. This is the only series I can think of that's trying to deal with like the difficulty of getting into a meditative state, of quieting your noisy brain, of trying to be your better self. And then the difficulty once you've gotten there of staying there. What made you think of this as the idea of a series?
Well, the truth is I kind of had my own process of getting into some of these, like meditating and yoga. And it came out of a really bad TV experience where I was running a show where by the end of the show, I was like sent the crazy email in the middle of the night to everybody and had sort of a nervous breakdown over the whole thing. I was just kind of overworked, and I'd gone through like a period of years where I was just burning my candle at both ends and, you know, made like 4 movies and 2 TV shows in the span of like 5 years. And I realized I had to like mellow out a little bit and try to not to be such a workaholic. And I didn't know how to do that. And I also wanted to try to assert to everybody else that I wasn't crazy. And so I thought that, you know, it took me a while to have the guts to go back to TV because it had been so brutal. But when they did, you know, HBO came to me and when Laura and I started talking about a show together, I liked the idea of somebody who was, had kind of come to the edge and then wanted to come back and try to get over themselves, I guess.
So what was your pitch to HBO?
Well, you know, Laura had her own, you know, she actually had the deal at HBO first. She was trying to come up with a show, and she kept talking to me about what writers I would suggest for doing a show with her at HBO. And after a couple conversations, I was like, I would want to party at HBO and with Laura. And I started to think more seriously about getting back into TV. Laura had a desire to do something that was kind of right after Obama was elected, and this feeling of after she had done some campaigning for him about, you know, these community activists, people that were just kind of regular people but that got more involved in the political process. Thematically, she wanted to do something about somebody who wanted to be an agent of change. And the idea changed a lot once I got involved, but that part of it was something that appealed to me as well. To tackle the idea of somebody whose main goal is not so much like, you know, dating or family or, you know, relationships, but was something kind of had a bigger ambition. And yet she wasn't like a forensics you know, police investigator.
You know, she wants to be her better self. And she was that person, the better self, when she was at the holistic rehab center or holistic therapy center in Hawaii, where, like, it was beautiful with the waves on the beach and the glorious sunrises and everybody, like, singing around the campfire. But then, you know, she gets home and, you know, it's back to work and to the grind and the traffic, and it's just impossible to hold on to that better self. Did you experience that at all? When you'd taken some time away from work, you'd studied a little bit of Buddhism and this and that, and then you're like you're throwing yourself back into like, you know, the stress again, and then what?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It kind of paralleled actually the making of the show for me because, you know, when I'm not working as much and I'm not stressed, my better side comes out and I'm, you know, I can have time for other people and I can be patient. And the stress of running a TV show is, you know, it's really a around-the-clock kind of pressure. And if you want it to be a good show, you can kind of make yourself crazy. And so, yeah, I mean, like, you know, all of my old kind of compulsive tweaker habits started to, you know, emerge while I was even making the show. So it's harder to put some of that sort of Buddhist philosophy into practice once you're outside of the cushier berth of the meditation room, you know, or the yoga room.
So did you actually go on a retreat like the character in your TV series did? Or did you, were you in?
Well, it was more freaky than that. What happened is I had this kind of breakdown at work when I was running this TV show, and I started having panic attacks, and then basically I woke up one morning and I was like thinking I was having a heart attack. I was having a panic attack. I'd never had one before, so I didn't really know what was going on. I thought I was just dying. I was dying. And so I went to see some psychiatrist and I was like, you know, he was like asking me if I was like suicidal. And I was like, well, I just want to throw myself in front of a bus, but you know, it's not nothing more than that. But
excuse me for laughing.
Nothing that, you know, whatever, the typical stuff. But, and so like the next thing you know, I was like actually being checked into like a hospital where I was like, you know, not going to have my own, you know, I was thinking I was going to go to like the Ritz-Carlton and like have a burger and some tranquilizers or something. And it was much more like I was, you know, like people were shuffling around, like, you know, clearly medicated. I was like, I'm not crazy. I'm just really stressed. And I, you know, I need to, this is just going to make it worse. I'm not, you know, this isn't right. So I like escaped this place, just drove, ran to my car and like got in my car. And the psychiatrist had taken it upon himself. I don't know why I'm telling this story, but might as well. But he had called my office and said, oh yeah, Mike's not coming back. He's going somewhere where he can get the help that he needs. And I was like, and so there are all these people who were leaving messages on my machine, all of these producers and studio executives and network executives who are like crying and being like, don't worry about the show, just get the help. And I was heading back to work and I was like, this is not gonna, I don't really know what to do. And so like within a few days the show had been shut down and I was like, it was over. And so it kind of just, you know, it was like I was like, you know, a cartoon character who like the Wile E. Coyote that just slams against a wall and then is like, you know, butterflies flying over my head. Like, I didn't know where to go. I just didn't know what to do. I just knew that I had completely bombed out. So, yeah, I mean, I went through this period where I was just like, what do I do now? So, and that feeling like, you know, just going back and burying myself in work, which is what I used to do, just didn't seem like the healthiest response.
So did you go someplace away?
I never did that. I did start like meditating and stuff, but I've always been sort of afraid of like meditating in like a big group setting because I didn't think I could hack it. But I have done that, some of that more now, but it was really more just a kind of a walkabout where I was just traveling and reading and just trying to just calm down.
Did you find it hard to do that? And did you find it hard to quiet your mind and just sit alone with yourself?
Yeah, well, like in like Amy, in that episode that, you know, you played the clip from, I feel is very true to my experience, which is like, you know, meditating can bring up the most stressful thoughts, you know, especially if you haven't done a lot of it, and to actually try to stop that constant chatter of, you know, I need to do this, I need to do that, this is what's wrong with me. I think that's the hardest thing for many people to do, especially in our modern, you know, kind of like achievement oriented, you know, everybody's running around so manic. It's I think one of the most difficult things. And what's interesting too is I think when we turned in the show, the sort of more quiet, meditative aspects of the show made HBO the most nervous. And just in general, it was like, well, just because I think people, you know, especially in TV, first they want their comedies funny and they want their dramas juicy and kind of operatic. And this is very internal. And especially these kind of moments that Amy has where she's really sort of going inside and where it slows down a little bit. I think that that's something that just in general makes a network executive worry that you're going to lose your audience and people are going to click off or change the channel. That's not what people are looking for when they're zoning out in front of the TV.
So one more thing. So you have this kind of breakdown because the stress of this TV show that you were running was just too much. And then so you go to a psychiatric facility, escape from there, and then the show shut down a few days later. So on top of all the stress you were feeling, did you then feel guilt, too, that the show is shut down because you were gone?
Yeah. Well, also because, you know, when you're running a show, there's like at least, you know, hundreds of people, maybe not hundreds, but over 100 people who are making their living off the show. So when that happened, yeah, you feel like, you know, yeah, you've really bombed out. And especially when it's a show, like I had actors that were really good act, you know, you sort of feel like you're hosting a party and then the party sucks and it just doesn't end. And so like every day you're like, cause there was so much fighting on that particular show between what I was trying to do and what the network wanted from the show. And by the end when, you know, and trying to compromise and make everybody happy, I just kind of made something that nobody was happy with. Not me, not the network. You just sort of feel like you just like every day have to show up and be like, I know this party sucks, but I don't know what to do it. I don't know how to get out of it. And so it was just like this constant, yeah. And then when it all fell apart, in a way I was kind of relieved just because I didn't have to see everyone. I was just kind of failing alone now back in my house, which I'm more comfortable with. But it was definitely an alter, you know. But I do think that those kinds of things, and this is very Buddhist too, which is something that feels like the worst case scenario at the time can often be the gift. You know, was a huge kind of a life experience and a maturation experience for me. And it was very meaningful to me and it helped me direct me in a way that hopefully, you know, I am living my life a little bit more in a kind of saner way, I guess.
When you first started writing the series for HBO, how far ahead did you have to think of what was going to happen to each of the characters, where the storylines were going to go? Did you have to have a whole season mapped out before you can really begin so you know what your destination is?
Well, when you pitch a show, you kind of give them a sense of where the show would be going. I think it's helpful as far as sort of them getting their head around what it is. I was in a really fortunate position because they picked up the show pretty quickly and Laura was still committed to a movie that was shooting. So we had kind of a long prep period before the pilot started shooting. And because I'd had this experience before in TV where, you know, people are like, oh, we want to be in business with you, and you sell them something, but they really don't want what it is that you're trying to do, you know, and that's happened to me more than once, where it feels like they kind of don't want the thing that you're doing, but they don't want to lose you. So I was like, I really want to just write this season before we get too far down the road with this, so that HBO, if they do pick up the show, they really know exactly what it is that I want to do here. And it'll be fine if they don't want to pick it up, but I don't want them picking it up and then being like, oh, we want, you know, X. And I was just kind of a junkyard dog. And even though my agents were like, this isn't practical because, you know, you're kind of doing free work in a sense, it would just made me sleep easier because I just didn't want to be in some situation where I was kind of trying to transform the thing I wanted to do into something else that I didn't know how to do or didn't want to do.
There's another scene I want to play from Enlightened, and this is a scene from the fourth episode, and it doesn't give away any plot, but Amy, the Laura Dern character, and her ex-husband are going on this rafting trip, and there they meet the guide for this group of people who are rafting. I just want to play him introducing himself to the group that signed up for him to guide them on the rafting trip.
I've introduced myself to some of you. For the rest of you, I'm Rick. I used to write for television. Wow. Rockford Files, Mr. James Garner.
Oh, Rockford Files.
Kojak.
Great.
Yeah, they took all my ideas. Who Loves You, Baby? That was my line. I did the whole Hollywood thing. But it's a special layer of hell down there. I mean, really sick. So, I'm a poet of the river now.
Cool.
What we're going to do is today we're going to be kayaking.
So that's a scene from Enlightened. And Mike White, I think that scene is so funny. And honestly, watching it, I thought, like, this guy's got to be the real thing. Like, this is definitely a former Hollywood writer who now does, like, who's now a river guide. Who is he?
That character is a version of me, honestly. He's like this, like, gruff man of the river, which is not me. But there's those moments where screenwriters, TV writers who are real put upon, you know, like feel like they've, you know, I think that's the kind of quintessential condition of the TV writer, feeling like they are being pushed around by the powers that be. And so, you know, in those moments you fantasize about, you know, oh, I could move up the state and I, you know, I'll become a river guide, or I'll do some alternate form of, you know, I'll escape from this. And I sometimes I have that fantasy myself, which is like, I'm just going to open a donkey sanctuary somewhere by the beach somewhere. And so I thought that would be a funny character to send them down the river.
Okay. I want to go back to kind of where we started from, which is that, you know, after you kind of had this stressed out meltdown because of pressures from a TV show that you were writing, you took a break, learned how to meditate for a while, and then went back to work. Now, you've been on the show several times, and we've talked about this before, but you grew up in, you know, a religious family, you know, fundamentalists, evangelicals, and your father, Mel White, ghost wrote the memoirs for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and other people on the Christian right, and then later came out as gay and really tried so hard to get Jerry Falwell to change his beliefs about homosexuality. I think he failed on that.
I think so.
Yeah, but anyways, you know, a lot of people, when they went through the kind of meltdown that you had, would have turned to a more Western religion. You turned to Buddhism, but not in a religious sense, just in, like, learning the practices of meditation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and studying, you know, just studying, I don't know exactly what you studied, but, you know, studying Buddhism. But anyways, how did you know that what you wanted to turn to was something that had more to do with meditation than with something more literal about God?
Well, truthfully, I somehow I got into reading certain Buddhist sort of self-help books. There's this writer, Pema Chodron, and then from her I would start reading other books. And I was just kind of a autodidact or a dilettante, just going through the section in my bookstore. But the truth was that those books became, I mean, I still read them all the time. It's just, I find it very, you know, if I'm not actually sitting and meditating, I can get into that frame of mind. And I did grow up in a Christian household, but I always felt like there's this element to the organized aspect of religion that I just never got it. And then I, you know, in the secular world and this, you know, schooling that I had, you know, I went to college during the early 90s when, you know, all of this French deconstructionist philosophy, this critical theory stuff that I was reading. So, and it was all about how nothing is true and all our institutions are false and how, you know, all of the constructs that we create that are these fallacies that we live our life under. And at the time I was like, this is the truth. And it was, you know, really stimulating and exciting for me. And at the same time, at some point you come to the end of it and you're like, okay, well, what now? If everything is false and it's all a lie, and, you know, we're, you know, even our personalities are fraudulent or whatever, you know, how do you live a constructive and creative and positive, hopefully, life beyond just poking holes in all of the falseness? And I think that's what attracted me to Buddhism, in a sense, because I think it comes from this place where it starts at, you know, everything isn't, there is no truth with a capital T, and there is no, you know, there's no self even, but that there's something about, you know, engaging in the world of compassion and other people's suffering, that is what our purpose here is. And that's something, as a writer and as a person, it just didn't bump me. You know, there's just, when I would read other sort of religious writings, there was always something that I just was never comfortable with. And something about some of this, particularly Tibetan Buddhist writing, it was just like, oh, I could read this and I'd be like, you know, all of this I agree with. And it actually feels nourishing in some kind of internal way for me.
Well, that's a nice thought to end on, and very much connects to Enlightened, your new series. So thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with the series. So, be well and thank you.
Awesome, Terry.
Mike White speaking with Terry Gross. Mike White co-created and wrote all the episodes in the new HBO series Enlightened, which premiered last week. A new album, The Lost Notebooks of Hank Williams, finds a number of major country and rock musicians setting to music lyrics that Hank Williams left behind in four notebooks when he died in 1953. Bob Dylan, Alan Jackson, Jack White, and Nora Jones are among the artists who have taken part in this unusual project. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Time after time, you've proven untrue, leaving me home to cry over you. Each time you come back and say I'm your sweetheart, but how many times did you broken my heart?
One must feel ambivalent about this album, The Lost Notebooks of Hank Williams. Yes, it does give us an opportunity to hear some previously unreleased lyrics by one of the greatest songwriters country music has produced. But Williams didn't write the music that accompanies his words, and as sincere as these performers are, none of the words are framed the way Williams would have had he completed the songwriting process. Would Hank, for example, have set The Love That Faded to a waltz beat, as Bob Dylan has done with it?
The love that faded left me only tears. Days that were happy turned into lonely years. Vows that we made turned into lies. My life is empty, my lonely heart cries.
I like that performance in the way that I like so many of Dylan's latter-day gargling with Drano vocal turns. Dylan doesn't try to capture the sound of Hank Williams, and that's a good strategy. But so is Alan Jackson's on You've Been Lonesome Too. And if anything, Jackson sounds like an uncannily well-rested, well-preserved version of Hank himself.
If your heart has known such pain until for death it's cried, only to have the Lord refuse, then you've been near my side. If in your heart somehow you know you'll fail whatever you do, then you have walked a road of pain. Yes, you've been lonesome too.
One of the greatest gifts of this project is to hear Williams at his most heartless, bitter, and vengeful. Hank spent much of his career balancing songs of heartache with spiritual songs of faith. But I was thrilled to hear the dark Hank Williams, as presented by Vince Gill and Rodney Crowell, in their stark version of a great, ruthless lyric, "I Hope You Shed a Million Tears."
See you clear as day there on our wedding night. The warm glow of your heart so gay and your eyes blue shining bright. Your lips were like a rose red wine the stars alone can yield. My one and only Valentine, my lily of the field.
Instead of heartache, heartlessness. Dismissals don't get much more decisive than that. Dylan was the first artist contacted to interpret this material, and the album has been released on his Egyptian Records imprint for Columbia Records. "I Hope You Shed a Million Tears' stone-cold words can't help but remind me of the harsh Dylan of Like a Rolling Stone or something from Blood on the Tracks." Similarly, Patti Loveless takes another face-slap lyric, "You're Through Fooling Me," and brings it to full crimson passion and beauty.
I know someday I'll forget you, until that day I'll be sober. Go on and have your fun, 'cause baby, this race is run. You ain't the kind that can be true. You like cheating, all that you do. You're through fooling me, 'cause I'm through fooling with you. Oh, love is true.
It's interesting to see the lyrics of one song as printed on the CD jacket of the Lost Notebooks, and to listen to where the line breaks occur in the singing of the others. Williams usually wrote here in quatrains, each verse a very direct A-B-A-B rhyme scheme. Keeping the structure simple allowed him to speak directly yet artfully. There's a flaw in this collection, however. Too frequently, the invited stars err on the side of caution, applying rather pallid, even rudimentary melodies to the lyrics, resulting in washed-out backgrounds on songs covered by, for example, Sheryl Crow, Lucinda Williams, and Jacob Dylan. Then there's Jack White's labored impersonation of the wrong Hank. He sounds more like Hank Williams III, the wobbliest member of the Williams family to trade on the great man's name.
Now you know that I know that you ain't no good, and you wouldn't tell the truth even if you could. Lying is a habit you practice wherever you go. Well, you may fool the rest of this world, but you know that I know.
Overall, however, The Lost Notebooks of Hank Williams is catnip for anyone who's familiar with Williams' greatest hits. A couple of these songs could have been crafted by the man himself into important additions to his canon. As it stands, we have these reverent and sometimes inspired interpretations of words that ring with graceful candor.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Lost Notebooks of Hank Williams. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Jeffrey Eugenides, is the author of The Virgin Suicides, which was adapted into a film by Sofia Coppola, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Middlesex, about a hermaphrodite. His new novel, The Marriage Plot, is about academia, literature, religion, and love. It opens as three students are graduating from college and entering the world as young adults. Madeline is an English major in love with Leonard, whom she discovers is a manic depressive. Leonard is a scientist, sometimes immobilized by his depression. Mitchell is obsessed with Madeline. But Mitchell also is absorbed in investigating religion and travels to India to work in a home founded by Mother Teresa for people who are destitute and dying. That part of the story is loosely based on the time when Eugenides worked at a home founded by Mother Teresa. Terry spoke with him last week.
Jeffrey Eugenides, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to start with a short reading, and this is the paragraph I think of as the title song of the book because it reveals why the book has the title that it does. So would you read this paragraph for us? And it's about Madeline, and she's the woman who's about to graduate who is an English major and also studying semiotics.
Right. She's an English major. She's about to graduate. She's a little disenchanted with her English studies, and this is why. Her junior year, Madeline had taken an honors seminar called The Marriage Plot, selected novels of Austin, Eliot, and James. The class was taught by Kay McCall Saunders. Saunders was a 79-year-old New Englander. He had a long, horsey face and a moist laugh that exposed his gaudy dental work. His pedagogical method consisted of his reading aloud lectures he'd written 20 or 30 years earlier. Madeline stayed in the class because she felt sorry for Professor Saunders and because the reading list was so good. In Saunders's opinion, the novel had reached its apogee with The Marriage Plot and had never recovered from its disappearance. In the days when success in life had depended on marriage and marriage had depended on money, novelists had had a subject to write about. The great epics sang of war, the novel of marriage. Sexual equality, good for women, had been bad for the novel, and divorce had undone it completely. What would it matter whom Emma married if she could file for separation later? How would Isabel Archer's marriage to Gilbert Osmond have been affected by the existence of a prenup? As far as Saunders was concerned, marriage didn't mean much anymore, and neither did the novel. Where could you find The Marriage Plot nowadays? You couldn't. You had to read historical fiction. You had to read non-Western novels involving traditional societies, Afghani novels, Indian novels. You had to go, literally speaking, back in time.
Do you agree with that perception that there's a certain type of novel that's dead because people just don't live that way anymore? People don't necessarily expect that marriage is the end of the story or ensures happiness or even endures.
I do believe it, and this book arose out of lamenting that fact. I've seen people still get away with it. Someone like Vikram Seth, who wrote A Suitable Boy, was able to do it. And I guess I envied writers like that who came from a world where these kind of social constrictions were still normative and they could write marriage plots. I couldn't, being an American born in 1960, and I kind of wished I could. I didn't think that I could. I didn't think it was possible to write a Jane Austen novel now, and in fact it isn't. But I did want to sort of traffic in the same ideas.
And this is what's also killing a certain type of novel, is semiotics and the study of semiotics. And Madeline, the character in your book, is studying semiotics. And I'm going to ask you to explain what that is and how it applies in a lot of colleges to the study of fiction.
Well, semiotics, you know, the definition of it is the study of signs. And basically what it is a way of examining the underlying structures of systems. Now, in literature, instead of reading a text and figuring out what that text means, semiotics examines how the text gives meaning. I could give an example.
Yeah, please.
There's a love story. If there's a love story, the old way of reading it would be to think about the characters and the setting and perhaps what it says about social class. Semiotics, however, would look at a love story and compare it to all the other love stories that had been written and try to find the correspondences, the things that happen in all of those love stories. And in that way, you know, show the artificiality of love stories. It works very well for movies. You can think of Rita Hayworth and Gilda shaking her hair out in that opening shot, or Marlene Dietrich smoking a cigarette. These are codes that are romantic and sexual, and we learn to read them as viewers. It's the same with literature. There are these tropes that are romantic tropes. So semiotics would focus on that, and in so doing, it kind of empties literature and the text of meaning because it does point out how it's fabricated, how repetitive it is. And if you follow this line long enough, you get to deconstruction, where a theorist would be looking for internal contradictions or paradoxes in a text that would essentially render the text meaningless. At the end of this line, you're saying that writing can't really mean anything because it's internally inconsistent. So if you're a writer going to college and you're learning these things, it puts a shiver of fear in you because it's basically saying that your attempt is doomed to fail.
Well, what you're describing is literature classes that are all about finding how a text is meaningless, like finding the reason for meaninglessness as opposed to finding meaning and also finding like beauty or wit or...
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it becomes a kind of world philosophy. And it seemed to me at the time, for all of its intelligence, a slightly nihilistic one.
So there's the character of Madeline in your novel, The Marriage Plot. And she's wrestling with, you know, her love of, like, you know, 19th century romantic fiction mm-hmm. and trying to reconcile that with the semiotics that she's studying. And in the meantime, she falls in love with someone who she doesn't realize yet is manic depressive. And as the depression starts to take over, she starts seeing, like, a different man than she thought she knew. She still loves him, but he's kind of immobilized by depression. You have a great description. You write, "This was depression, this monotone monologue delivered by an unbathed guy lying on his back in the middle of the floor." And I think a lot of people will have known somebody who fits that description or maybe thinks that they have fit that description at one time or another. Why did you want to bring that kind of really serious depression into the novel?
Well, the novel began with a sentence about Madeline that goes, "Madeline's love troubles began at a time when the French theory she was reading deconstructed the very notion of love." And I had this idea of a woman who was becoming skeptical of romance and also at the same time was falling in love. And then I had to imagine who is she falling in love with. And I had the idea to have her be in love with a manic depressive because this person was at certain times the most engaging, the most energetic, the most exciting person she'd ever met. And at other times, the most depressed, the most needy, the most insufferable. And that just appealed to me as a difficulty in love, you know, greater than most.
You seem to understand what it's like to need to take a medicine for manic depression, but at the same time to hate to take it because the side effects are so bad. You write from the perspective of Leonard about the horrible metallic taste in his mouth and, you know, having his, mm-hmm. you know, libido seriously diminished and feeling fuzzy. And at the same time, you write about it from Madeline's point of view that she's kissing this, like, really sour mouth.
That's true. I had to do a little research into what lithium would do. And it actually doesn't decrease your libido, but it does other things that make you depressed enough that would decrease your libido.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the love affair begins with so much passion, this is both troubling to her and obviously to Leonard. But I did meet someone once who was bipolar, and she told me that she kind of tried to rig her medicine to keep her toward the upper register of the continuum so that she would have more energy. Obviously, she didn't want to boil over into mania, but she wanted to stay high. I mean, it occurred to me that manic depression is the only disease that in certain times is a benefit and is actually good. Schizophrenia is not that way. Depression's not that way. There's nothing good about those, but there is this kind of sweet spot in manic depression that manic depressives talk about, and that interested me a great deal.
So let's talk about your character of Mitchell, and this is the character who's in love with Madeline. She cares about him as a friend, doesn't feel like he's really a lover for her, and he's kind of carrying around for quite a long time this obsession with her, and because he is very interested in religion, and particularly in its more mystical side, and because he needs to free himself from his obsession with Madeline, he leaves and goes to Calcutta and works at Mother Teresa's, at a home for the dying. And he'd never so much as changed a baby's diaper before. He never nursed a sick person, and now he's nursing people with, you know, leprosy and other like terrible diseases and wounds. And you had done that. You worked there for a while. So I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt from that section.
All right. The bodies at the home for the dying destitutes, broken, diseased, were the bodies of Christ, divinity immanent in each one. What you were supposed to do here was to take this scripture literally, to believe it strongly and earnestly enough that, by some alchemy of the soul, it happened. You looked into a dying person's eyes and saw Christ looking back. This hadn't happened to Mitchell. He didn't expect it to. But by the end of his second week, he had become uncomfortably aware that he was performing only the simplest, least demanding tasks at the home. He hadn't given anyone a bath, for instance. Bathing the patients was the main service that the foreign volunteers provided. Every morning, Sven and Ellen, who had a landscaping business back in Minnesota, worked their way down the line of beds, assisting men to the lavatory on the other side of the building. If the men were too weak or sick to walk, Sven got the beekeeper or the Anglican minister to help carry the stretcher. While Mitchell sat administering head massages, he watched people who looked in no way extraordinary perform the extraordinary task of cleaning and wiping the sick and dying men who populated the home, bringing them back to their beds with their hair wet, their spindly bodies wrapped in fresh bedclothes. Day after day, Mitchell managed not to help with this. He was afraid to bathe the men. He was scared of what their naked bodies might look like, of the diseases and wounds that might lie under their robes, and he was afraid of their bodily effluvia, of his hands touching their urine and excrement.
What was your reaction when you started to work at Mother Teresa's and you were exposed to the kinds of illnesses and wounds that your character of Mitchell is?
Pretty much the same as that. I remember arriving at first and just getting through the day, figuring out what kind of job I could do, and I was doing the simpler jobs, but feeling very proud of myself for just being there. And then as I stayed, I had the same realization Mitchell does, that I wasn't doing the hard tasks and that I was squeamish, and I was trying to force myself past that point.
You know, you can find people in your neighborhood nursing home who need to be bathed, who have wounds, who are dying of horrible illnesses, and volunteer there. Or you can go to Calcutta and, you know, yeah, work right. in Mother, you yeah. know, in the late Mother Teresa's place. Mm. And I would assume that if you're working with Mother Teresa, that there's some kind of spiritual edge or beliefs or something that kind of hover over the home. And that in your average nursing home, that's probably not true. I mean, but did you feel different at Mother Teresa's than you think you might have at your neighborhood nursing home?
Well, I felt more dramatic being there. And I think part of my pull there was that's kind of the Super Bowl of altruism, to go all the way to India and help with Mother Teresa. And the other people were coming from all over the world to volunteer. So there was this sense of a mission. I mean, not everyone was religious who showed up, but everyone came there, and it was obviously imbued with her presence, even though she wasn't physically there while I was there. And it was, you know, it was in a way I was sincere about it. I was doing the best I could, and yet I was also going through a stage and play acting a saintly life. It's as you do when you're young. You're trying out a self and seeing if it works and if it sticks, and that's what I was doing. But it was, you know, obviously it was an incredibly meaningful event in my life because I've been trying to write about it for 30 years unsuccessfully and finally did it. Now I maybe have gotten rid of it, but it took a long time.
There's a romantic triangle at the core of your novel, and that's in a lot of ways, it's like the oldest story in the books, the romantic
right.
triangle, and right. you know that. That's not news to you.
That's, no, I do that.
That's an old, you know, a really old story. But you had to give it, like, your personal version of that story. Why did you want to tackle something like a romantic triangle, knowing as you do how potentially tired that story could be, how hard it is to breathe life into it, but at the same time, how constantly real it is, because, like, who hasn't been in that situation and suffered?
I never thought the word triangle I was writing in. I just thought first of Madeline and her boyfriend, and then I had Mitchell there. I mean, it was definitely operating for me, but I wasn't aware of it. But I had this idea, you know, it's the epigraph for the book, no one would fall in love if they hadn't heard love talked about. So I was trying to deal with this idea of a love triangle, not in the way where it really matters what happens between the characters, but in a way that you could see how their expectations about love draw them together and draw them apart. I mean, the marriage plot is no longer a possibility for a contemporary novelist, but you know, what I discovered in writing this book is that the marriage plot still plays itself out in our heads. We grow up reading a lot of books like this, 19th century novels, and seeing romantic films, and we might be enlightened, but we still often expect to find the one true love or to spend our lives with a single person, and a lot of our decisions in life are geared that way, even now. So it's still existing. I mean, the way I deal with a triangle like this is to show that it actually is not exhausted, that these old patterns continue to repeat themselves in our actual lives. And that's the semiotic side of it, at the same time as it's an extremely old-fashioned idea. I mean, the book is a marriage plot, and it isn't a marriage plot. It's old-fashioned, and at the same time, it's not averse to modernity.
Jeffrey Eugenides, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Eugenides speaking with Terry Gross. His new novel is called The Marriage Plot. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.